Way Eberhard had run the company, and called in a fixer to address the situation. One of Tesla's investors was Valor Equity, a Chicago-based investment firm that specialized in fine-tuning manufacturing operations. The company had been drawn to Tesla's battery and powertrain technology and calculated that even if Tesla failed to sell many cars, the big automakers would end up wanting to buy its intellectual property. To protect its investment, Valor sent in Tim Watkins, its managing director of operations, and he soon reached some horrific conclusions. Watkins is a Brit with degrees in industrial robotics and electrical engineering. He's built up a reputation as an ingenious solver of problems. While doing work in Switzerland, for example, Watkins found a way to get around the country's rigid labor laws that limit the hours employees can work by automating a metal stamping factory so that it could run 24 hours per day instead of 16 hours like the factories of rivals. Watkins is also known for keeping his ponytail in place with a black scrunchie, wearing a black leather jacket, and toting a black fanny pack everywhere he goes. The fanny pack has his passport, checkbook, earplugs, sunscreen, food, and an assortment of other necessities. "It's full of the everyday things I need to survive," said Watkins. "If I walk 10 feet away from this thing, I sense it." While a bit eccentric, Watkins was thorough and spent weeks talking to employees and analyzing every part of Tesla's supply chain to figure out how much it cost to make the Roadster. Tesla had done a decent job of keeping its employee costs down. It hired the kid fresh out of Stanford for $45,000 rather than the proven guy who probably didn't want to work that hard anyway for $120,000. But when it came to equipment and materials, Tesla was a spending horror show. No one liked using the company's software that tracked the bill of materials. So some people used it, and some people didn't. Those that did use it often made huge errors. They would take the cost of a part from the prototype cars and then estimate how much of a discount they expected when buying that part in bulk, rather than actually negotiating to find a viable price. At one point, the software declared that each Roadster should cost about $68,000, which would leave Tesla making about $30,000 per vehicle. Everyone knew the figure was wrong, but it got reported to the board anyway. Around the middle of 2007, Watkins came to Musk with his findings. Musk was prepared for a high figure, but felt confident that the price of the car would come down significantly over time as Tesla ironed out its manufacturing process and increased its sales. "That's when Tim told me it was really bad news," Musk said. "It looked like each Roadster would cost up to $200,000 to make, and Tesla planned to sell the car for only around $85,000. Even in full production, they would have been like $170,000 or something insane," Musk said. "Of course, it didn't much matter, because about a third of the cars didn't flat-out fucking work." Eberhard made attempts to pull his team out of this mess. He'd gone to see a speech in which the famous venture capitalist John Doerr, who became a major investor in green technology companies, declared that he would devote his time and money to trying to save the Earth from global warming, because he owed such an effort to his children. Eberhard promptly returned to the Tesla building and ginned up a similar speech. In front of about 100 people, Eberhard had a picture of his young daughter projected onto the wall of the main workshop. He asked the Tesla engineers why he had put that picture up. One of them guessed that it was because people like his daughter would drive the car. To which Eberhard replied, "No. We are building this because by the time she is old enough to drive, she will know a car as something completely different to how we know it today. Just like you don't think of a phone as a thing on the wall with a cord on it. It's this future that depends on you." Eberhard then thanked some of the key engineers and called out their efforts in public. Many of the engineers had been pulling all-nighters on a regular basis, and Eberhard's show boosted morale. "We were all working ourselves to the point of exhaustion," said David Vespremi, a former Tesla spokesman. Then came this profound moment where we were reminded that building the car was not about getting to an IPO or selling it to a bunch of rich dudes, but because it might change what a car is. These victories, though, were not enough to overcome the feeling shared by many of the Tesla engineers that Eberhard had reached the end of his abilities as a CEO. The company veterans had always admired Eberhard's engineering smarts and continued to do so. Eberhard, in fact, had turned Tesla into a cult of engineering. Regrettably, other parts of the company had been neglected, and people doubted Eberhard's ability to take the company from the R&D stage to production. The ridiculous cost of the car, the transmission, the ineffective suppliers were crippling Tesla. And as the company started to miss its delivery dates, many of the once fanatical consumers who had made their large upfront payments turned on Tesla and Eberhard. "We saw the writing on the wall," Lyons said. "Everyone knew that the person who starts a company is not necessarily the right person to lead it in the long term. But whenever that is the case, it's not easy." Eberhard and Musk had battled for years over some of the design points on the car. But for the most part, they had gotten along well enough. Neither man suffered fools, and they certainly shared many of the same visions for the battery technology and what it could mean to the world. What their relationship could not survive were the cost figures for the Roadster unearthed by Watkins. It looked to Musk as if Eberhard had grossly mismanaged the company by allowing the parts costs to soar so high. Then, as Musk saw it, Eberhard failed to disclose the severity of the situation to the board. While on his way to give a talk to the Motor Press Guild in Los Angeles, Eberhard received a call from Musk, and in a brief, uncomfortable chat, learned that he would be replaced as CEO. In August 2007, Tesla's board demoted Eberhard and named him President of Technology, which only exacerbated the company's issues. "Martin was so bitter and disruptive," Straubel said. "I remember him running around the office and sowing discontent as we're trying to finish the car and are running out of money and everything is at knife's edge." As Eberhard saw it, other people at Tesla had foisted a wonky finance software application on him that made it tricky to accurately track costs. He contended that the delays and cost increases were partly due to the request of other members of the management team, and that he'd been upfront with the board about the issues. Beyond that, he thought Watkins had made the situation out to be worse than it really was. Startups in Silicon Valley view mayhem as standard operating procedure. "Valor was used to dealing with older companies," Eberhard said. "They found chaos and weren't used to it. This was the chaos of a startup." Besides all of that, Eberhard had already been asking Tesla's board to replace him as CEO and find someone with more manufacturing experience. A few months passed, and Eberhard remained pissed off. Many of the Tesla employees felt like they were caught in the middle of a divorce and had to pick their parent, Eberhard or Musk. By the time December arrived, the situation was untenable, and Eberhard left the company altogether. Tesla said in a statement that Eberhard had been offered a position on its advisory board, although he denied that. "I am no longer with Tesla Motors, neither on its board of directors nor an employee of any sort," Eberhard said in a statement at the time. "I'm not happy with the way I was treated." Musk sent a note to a Silicon Valley newspaper saying, "I'm sorry that it came to this and wish it were not so. It was not a question of personality differences, as the decision to have Martin transition to an advisory role was unanimous among the board. Tesla has operational problems that need to be solved, and if the board thought there was any way that Martin could be part of the solution, then he would still be an employee of the company." These statements were the start of a war that would drag on between the two men in public for years, and that in many ways continues to the present day. As 2007 played out, the problems mounted for Tesla. The carbon fiber body that looked so good turned out to be a huge pain to paint, and Tesla had to cycle through a couple of companies to find one that could do the work well. Sometimes there were faults in the battery pack. The motor short-circuited now and again. The body panels had visible gaps. The company also had to face up to the reality that a two-speed transmission was not going to happen. In order for the Roadster to achieve its flashy 0 to 60 times with a single-speed transmission, Tesla's engineers had to redesign the car's motor and inverter and shave off some weight. "We essentially had to do a complete reboot," Musk said. "That was terrible." After Eberhard was removed as CEO, Tesla's board tapped Michael Marx as its interim chief. Marx had run Flextronics, an enormous electronics supplier, and had deep experience with complex manufacturing operations and logistics issues. Marx began interrogating various groups at the company to try to figure out their problems and to prioritize the issues plaguing the Roadster. He also put in some basic rules, like making sure that people all showed up at work at the same time, to establish a baseline of productivity. A tricky ask in Silicon Valley's work-anywhere, anytime culture. All of these moves were part of the Marx List, a 10-point, 100-day plan that included eliminating all faults in the battery packs, getting gaps between body parts to less than 40 millimeters, and booking a specified number of reservations. Martin had been falling apart and lacked a lot of the discipline key for a manager, Straubel said. Michael came in and evaluated the mess and was a bullshit filter. He didn't really have a dog in the fight and could say, "I don't care what you think or what you think. This is what we should do." For a while, Marx's strategy worked, and the engineers at Tesla could once again focus on building the Roadster rather than on internal politics. But then Marx's vision for the company began to diverge from Musk's. By this time, Tesla had moved into a larger facility at 1050 Bing Street in San Carlos. The bigger building allowed Tesla to bring the battery work back in-house from Asia and for it to do some of the Roadster manufacturing, alleviating the supply chain issues. Tesla was maturing as a car company, although its wild child startup streak remained well intact. While strolling around the factory one day, Marx saw a smart car from Daimler on a lift. Musk and Straubel had a small side project going on around the smart car to see what it might be like as an electric vehicle. "Michael didn't know about it, and he's like, 'Who is the CEO here?'" said Lyons. The work on the smart car eventually led to Daimler buying a 10% stake in Tesla. Marx's inclination was to try to package Tesla as an asset that could be sold to a larger car company. It was a perfectly reasonable plan. While running Flextronics, Marx had overseen a vast global supply chain and knew the difficulties of manufacturing intimately. Tesla must have looked borderline hopeless to him at this point. The company could not make its one product well, was poised to hemorrhage money, and had missed a string of delivery deadlines, and yet its engineers were still off doing side experiments. Making Tesla look as pretty as possible for a suitor was the rational thing to do. In just about every other case, Marx would be thanked for his decisive plan of action and saving the company's investors from a big loss. But Musk had little interest in polishing up Tesla's assets for the highest bidder. He'd started the company to put a dent in the automotive industry and force people to rethink electric cars. Instead of doing the fashionable Silicon Valley thing of pivoting toward a new idea or plan, Musk would dig in deeper. The product was late and over budget, and everything was wrong. But Elon didn't want anything to do with those plans to either sell the whole company or lose control through a partnership, Straubel said. So Elon decided to double down. On December 3, 2007, Zev Drory replaced Marx as CEO. Drory had experience in Silicon Valley starting a company that made computer memory and selling it to the chipmaker Advanced Micro Devices. Drory was not Musk's first pick. A top choice had turned down the job because he didn't want to move from the East Coast and did not inspire much enthusiasm from the Tesla employees. Drory had about 15 years on the youngest Tesla worker and no connection to this group bonded by suffering and toil. He came to be seen more as an executor of Musk's wishes than as a commanding independent CEO. Musk began making more public gestures to mitigate the bad press around Tesla. He issued statements and did interviews, promising that the Roadster would ship to customers in early 2008. He began talking up a car codenamed White Star, The Roadster had been codenamed Dark Star. There would be a sedan, possibly priced around $50,000, and a new factory to build the machine. Given the recent management changes, some reassurances are in order regarding Tesla Motors' future plans, Musk wrote in a blog post. The near-term message is simple and unequivocal. We are going to deliver a great sports car next year that customers will love driving. My car, production VIN-1, is already off the production line in the UK, and final preparations are being made for importation. Tesla held a series of town hall meetings with customers where it tried to fess up to its problems in the open, and it started building some showrooms for its car. Vince Salito, the former PayPal executive, visited the Menlo Park showroom and found Musk complaining about the public relations issues, but clearly inspired by the product Tesla was building. His demeanor changed the moment we got to this display of the motor, Salito said. Dressed in a leather jacket and slacks, Musk started talking about the motor's properties and then put on a performance worthy of a carnival strongman by lifting the 100 or so pound hunk of metal. He picks this thing up and wedges it between his two palms, Salito said. He's holding it, and he's shaking, and beads of sweat are forming on his forehead. It wasn't so much a display of strength as a physical demonstration of the beauty of the product. While the customers complained a lot about the delays, they seemed to sense this passion from Musk and share his enthusiasm for the product. Only a handful of customers asked for their prepayments back. Tesla employees soon got to witness the same Musk that SpaceX employees had seen for years. When an issue like the Roadster's faulty carbon fiber body panels cropped up, Musk dealt with it directly. He flew to England in his jet to pick up some new manufacturing tools for the body panels and personally delivered them to a factory in France to ensure that the Roadster stayed on its production schedule. The days of people being ambiguous about the Roadster's manufacturing costs were gone as well. Elon got fired up and said we were going to do this intense cost-down program, said Popple. He gave a speech saying we would work on Saturdays and Sundays and sleep under desks until it got done. Someone pushed back from the table and argued that everyone had been working so hard just to get the car done, and they were ready for a break and to see their families. Elon said, I would tell those people they will get to see their families a lot when we go bankrupt. I was like, wow, but I got it. I had come out of a military culture, and you just have to make your objective happen. Employees were required to meet at 7 a.m. every Thursday morning for bill of materials updates. They had to know the price of every part and have a cogent plan for getting parts cheaper. If the motor cost $6,500 a pop at the end of December, Musk wanted it to cost $3,800 by April. The costs were plotted and analyzed each month. If you started falling behind, there was hell to pay, Popple said. Everyone could see it, and people lost their jobs when they didn't deliver. Elon has a mind that's a bit like a calculator. If you put a number on the projector that does not make sense, he will spot it. He doesn't miss details. Popple found Musk's style aggressive, but he liked that Musk would listen to a well-argued analytical point and often change his mind if given a good enough reason. Some people thought Elon was too tough or hot-tempered or tyrannical, Popple said. But these were hard times, and those of us close to the operational realities of the company knew it. I appreciated that he didn't sugarcoat things. On the marketing front, Musk would run daily Google searches for news stories about Tesla. If he saw a bad story, he ordered someone to fix it, even though the Tesla public relations people could do little to sway the reporters. One employee missed an event to witness the birth of his child. Musk fired off an email saying, "That is no excuse. I am extremely disappointed. You need to figure out where your priorities are. We're changing the world and changing history, and you either commit or you don't." This was how the employee remembered the text. I did not see the actual email. Musk later told the same employee, "I want you to think ahead and think so hard every day that your head hurts. I want your head to hurt every night when you go to bed." Marketing people who made grammatical mistakes in emails were let go, as were other people who hadn't done anything awesome in recent memory. He can be incredibly intimidating at times, but doesn't have a real sense for just how imposing he can be, said one former Tesla executive. We'd have these meetings and take bets on who was going to get bloodied and bruised. If you told him that you made a particular choice because it was the standard way things had always been done, he'd kick you out of a meeting fast. He'd say, "I never want to hear that phrase again. What we have to do is fucking hard, and half-assing things won't be tolerated." He just destroys you, and if you survive, he determines if he can trust you. He has to understand that you're as crazy as he is. This ethos filtered through the entire company, and everyone quickly understood that Musk meant business. Straubel, while sometimes on the bad end of the critiques, welcomed Musk's hard-charging presence. The 5 years to get to this point had been an enjoyable slog for him. Straubel had transformed from a quiet, capable engineer who shuffled around Tesla's factory floor with his head down into the most crucial member of the technical team. He knew more about the batteries and the electric drivetrain than just about anyone else at the company. He also began developing a role as a go-between for employees and Musk. Straubel's engineering smarts and work ethic had earned Musk's respect, and Straubel found that he could deliver difficult messages to Musk on behalf of other employees. As he would do for years to come, Straubel also proved willing to check his ego at the door. All that mattered was getting the Roadster and the follow-on sedan to market to popularize electric cars, and Musk looked like the best person to make that happen. Other employees had enjoyed the thrill of the engineering challenge over the past 5 years, but were burnt out beyond repair. Wright didn't believe that an electric car for the masses would ever take off. He left and started his own company, dedicated to making electric versions of delivery trucks. Berdichevsky had been a crucial, do-anything young engineer for much of Tesla's existence. Now that the company employed about 300 people, he felt less effective and didn't relish the idea of suffering for another 5 years to bring the sedan to market. He would leave Tesla, get a couple of degrees from Stanford, and co-found a startup looking to make a revolutionary new battery that could soon go into electric cars. With Eberhard gone, Tarpaning found Tesla less fun. He didn't see eye to eye with Drory, and also shied away from the idea of frying his soul to get the sedan out. Lyon stuck around longer, which is a minor miracle. At various points, he had led the development of most of the core technology behind the Roadster, including the battery packs, the motor, the power electronics, and yes, the transmission. This meant that for about 5 years, Lyons had been among Tesla's most capable employees, and the guy constantly in the doghouse for being behind on something, and thus holding the rest of the company up. He suffered through some of Musk's more colorful tirades, directed either at him or suppliers that had let Tesla down, that included talk of people's balls being chopped off and other violent or sexual acts. Lyons also saw an exhausted, stressed-out Musk spit coffee across a conference room table because it was cold, and then, without a pause, demand that the employees work harder, do more, and mess up less. Like so many people privy to these performances, Lyons came away with no illusions about Musk's personality, but with the utmost respect for his vision and drive to execute. Working at Tesla back then was like being Kurtz in Apocalypse Now, Lyons said. Don't worry about the methods or if they're unsound. Just get the job done. It comes from Elon. He listens, asks good questions, is fast on his feet, and gets to the bottom of things. Tesla could survive the loss of some of these early hires. Its strong brand had allowed the company to keep recruiting top talent, including people from large automotive companies who knew how to get over the last set of challenges blocking the Roadster from reaching customers. But Tesla's major issue no longer revolved around effort, engineering, or clever marketing. Heading into 2008, the company was running out of money. The Roadster had cost about $140 million to develop, way over the $25 million originally estimated in the 2004 business plan. Under normal circumstances, Tesla had probably done enough to raise more funds, These, however, were not normal times. The big automakers in the United States were charging toward bankruptcy in the middle of the worst financial crisis since the Great Depression. In the midst of all this, Musk needed to convince Tesla's investors to fork over tens of millions of additional dollars, and those investors had to go to their constituents to lay out why this made any sense. As Musk put it, "Try to imagine explaining that you're investing in an electric car company, and everything you read about the car company sounds like it is shit and doomed, and it's a recession, and no one is buying cars." All Musk had to do to dig Tesla out of this conundrum was lose his entire fortune and verge on a nervous breakdown. Chapter 8. Pain, Suffering, and Survival. As he prepared to begin filming Iron Man in early 2007, the director Jon Favreau rented out a complex in Los Angeles that once belonged to Hughes Aircraft, the aerospace and defense contractor started about 80 years earlier by Howard Hughes. The facility had a series of interlocking hangars and served as a production office for the movie. It also supplied Robert Downey Jr., who was to play Iron Man, and his human creator Tony Stark, with a splash of inspiration. Downey felt nostalgic looking at one of the larger hangars, which had fallen into a state of disrepair. Not too long ago, that building had played host to the big ideas of a big man who shook up industries and did things his own way. Downey heard some rumblings about a Hughes-like figure named Elon Musk, who had constructed his own modern-day industrial complex about 10 miles away. Instead of visualizing how life might have been for Hughes, Downey could perhaps get a taste of the real thing. He set off in March 2007 for SpaceX's headquarters in El Segundo and wound up receiving a personal tour from Musk. "My mind is not easily blown, but this place and this guy were amazing," Downey said. To Downey, the SpaceX facility looked like a giant exotic hardware store. Enthusiastic employees were zipping about, fiddling with an assortment of machines. Young, white-collar engineers interacted with blue-collar assembly line workers, and they all seemed to share a genuine excitement for what they were doing. "It felt like a radical startup company," Downey said. After the initial tour, Downey came away pleased that the sets being hammered out at the Hughes factory did have parallels to the SpaceX factory. "Things didn't feel out of place," he said. Beyond the surroundings, Downey really wanted a peek inside Musk's psyche. The men walked, sat in Musk's office, and had lunch. Downey appreciated that Musk was not a foul-smelling, fidgety coder whack job. What Downey picked up on instead were Musk's accessible eccentricities, and the feeling that he was an unpretentious sort who could work alongside the people in the factory. Both Musk and Stark were the type of men, according to Downey, who had seized an idea to live by and something to dedicate themselves to, and were not going to waste a moment. When he returned to the Iron Man production office, Downey asked that Favreau be sure to place a Tesla Roadster in Tony Stark's workshop. On a superficial level, this would symbolize that Stark was so cool and connected that he could get a Roadster before it even went on sale. On a deeper level, the car was to be placed as the nearest object to Stark's desk so that it formed something of a bond between the actor, the character, and Musk. "After meeting Elon and making him real to me, I felt like having his presence in the workshop," Downey said. They became contemporaries. Elon was someone Tony probably hung out with and partied with, or more likely, they went on some weird jungle trek together to drink concoctions with the shamans. After Iron Man came out, Favreau began talking up Musk's role as the inspiration for Downey's interpretation of Tony Stark. It was a stretch on many levels. Musk is not exactly the type of guy who downs scotch in the back of a Humvee while part of a military convoy in Afghanistan. But the press lapped up the comparison, and Musk started to become more of a public figure. People who sort of knew him as that PayPal guy began to think of him as the rich, eccentric businessman behind SpaceX and Tesla. Musk enjoyed his rising profile. It fed his ego and provided some fun. He and Justine bought a house in Bel Air. Their neighbor to one side was Quincy Jones, the music producer, and their other neighbor was Joe Francis, the infamous creator of the Girls Gone Wild videos. Musk and some former PayPal executives, having settled their differences, produced Thank You for Smoking and used Musk's jet in the movie. While not a hard-drinking carouser, Musk took part in the Hollywood nightlife and its social scene. "There were just a lot of parties to go to," said Bill Lee, Musk's close friend. "Elon was neighbors with two quasi-celebrities. Our friends were making movies, and through this confluence of our networks, there was something to go out and do every night." In one interview, Musk calculated that his life had become 10% playboy and 90% engineer. "We had a domestic staff of five. During the day, our home transformed into a workplace," Justine wrote in a magazine article. "We went to black tie fundraisers and got the best tables at elite Hollywood nightclubs, with Paris Hilton and Leonardo DiCaprio partying next to us. When Google co-founder Larry Page got married on Richard Branson's private Caribbean island, we were there, hanging out in a villa with John Cusack and watching Bono pose with swarms of adoring women outside the reception tent." Justine appeared to relish their status even more than Musk. A writer of fantasy fiction novels, she kept a blog detailing the couple's family life and their adventures on the town. In one entry, Justine had Musk saying that he'd prefer to sleep with Veronica than Betty from the Archie comics, and that he'd like to visit a Chuck E. Cheese sometime. In another entry, she wrote about meeting Leonardo DiCaprio at a club and having him beg for a free Tesla Roadster, only to be turned down. Justine handed out nicknames to oft-occurring characters in the blog, so Bill Lee became Bill the Hotel Guy, because he owns a hotel in the Dominican Republic, and Joe Francis appeared as Notorious Neighbor. It's hard to imagine Musk, who keeps to himself, hanging out with someone as ostentatious as Francis, but the men got along well. When Francis took over an amusement park for his birthday, Musk attended and then ended up partying at Francis's house. Justine wrote, "E was there for a bit, but he admitted he also found it kind of lame. He's been to a couple of parties at NN's house now and ends up feeling self-conscious, because it just seems like there are always these skeevy guys wandering around the house trolling for girls. I don't want to be seen as one of those guys." When Francis got ready to buy a Roadster, he stopped by the Musk's house and handed over a yellow envelope with $100,000 in cash. For a while, the blog provided a rare, welcome glimpse into the life of an unconventional CEO. Musk seemed charming. The public learned that he bought Justine a 19th-century edition of Pride and Prejudice, that Musk's best friends gave him the nickname Alonius, and that Musk likes to place $1 wagers on all manner of things. Can you catch herpes from the Great Barrier Reef? Is it possible to balance two forks with a toothpick? That he knows he will win. Justine told one story about Musk traveling to Necker Island in the British Virgin Islands to hang out with Tony Blair and Richard Branson. A photo of the three men appeared later in the press that depicted Musk with a vacant stare. "This was E's I'm thinking about a rocket problem stance, which makes me pretty sure that he had just gotten some kind of bothersome work-related email and was clearly oblivious to the fact that a picture was being taken at all," she wrote. "This is also the reason I get such a kick out of it. The spouse the camera caught is the exact spouse I encountered, say, last night en route to the bathroom, standing in the hallway frowning with his arms folded." Justine letting the world into the couple's bathroom should have served as a warning of things to come. Her blog would soon turn into one of Musk's worst nightmares. The press had not run into a guy like Musk for a very long time. His shine as an internet millionaire kept getting, well, shinier, thanks to PayPal's ongoing success. He also had an element of mystery. There was the weird name, and there was the willingness to spend vast sums of money on spaceships and electric cars, which came across as a combination of daring, flamboyant, and downright flabbergasting. Elon Musk has been called part playboy, part space cowboy, an image hardly dispelled by a car collection that has boasted a Porsche 911 Turbo, 1967 Series 1 Jaguar, a Hammond BMW M5, plus the aforementioned McLaren F1, which he has driven at up to 215 miles per hour on a private airstrip, a British reporter gushed in 2007. Then there was the L-39 Soviet military jet, which he sold after becoming a father. The press had picked up on the fact that Musk tended to talk a huge game and then struggle to deliver on his promises in time, but they didn't much care. The game he talked was so much bigger than anyone else's that reporters were comfortable giving Musk leeway. Tesla became the darling of Silicon Valley's bloggers, who tracked its every move and were breathless in their coverage. Similarly, reporters covering SpaceX were overjoyed that a young, feisty company had arrived to needle Boeing, Lockheed, and to a large extent, NASA. All Musk had to do was eventually bring some of these wondrous things he'd been funding to market. While Musk put on a good show for the public and press, he'd started to get very worried about his businesses. SpaceX's second launch attempt had failed, and the reports coming in from Tesla kept getting worse. Musk had started these two adventures with a fortune nearing $200 million and had chewed through more than half the money with little to show for it. As each Tesla delay turned into a PR fiasco, the Musk glow dimmed. People in Silicon Valley began to gossip about Musk's money problems. Reporters who months earlier had been heaping adulation on Musk turned on him. The New York Times picked up on Tesla's transmission woes. Automotive websites griped that the Roadster might never ship. By the end of 2007, things got downright nasty. ValleyWag, Silicon Valley's gossip blog, began to take a particular interest in Musk. Owen Thomas, the site's lead writer, dug into the histories of Zip2 and PayPal and played up the times Musk was ousted as CEO to undermine some of his entrepreneurial street cred. Thomas then championed the premise that Musk was a master manipulator who played fast and loose with other people's money. "It's wonderful that Musk has realized even a small part of his childhood fantasies," Thomas wrote. "But he risks destroying his dreams by refusing to reconcile them with reality." ValleyWag anointed the Tesla Roadster as its number one fail of 2007 among technology companies. As his businesses and public persona suffered, Musk's home life degraded as well. His triplets, Kai, Damien, and Saxon, had arrived near the end of 2006 and joined their brothers Griffin and Xavier. According to Musk, Justine suffered from postpartum depression following the birth of the triplets. "In the spring of 2007, our marriage was having real issues," Musk said. "It was on the rocks." Justine's blog posts back up his sentiments. She described a much less romantic Musk and felt people treated her as an arm ornament who couldn't possibly have anything interesting to say, rather than as an author and her husband's equal. During one trip to St. Bart's, the Musks ended up sharing dinner with some wealthy, influential couples. When Justine let out her political views, one of the men at the table made a crack about her being so opinionated. "E chuckled back, patted my hand the way you pat a child's," Justine wrote on her blog. From that point on, Justine ordered Musk to introduce her as a published novelist and not just his wife and mother of his children. The results? E's way of doing this throughout the rest of the trip: "Justine wants me to tell you that she's written novels," which made people look at me like, "Oh, that's just so cute," and didn't really help my case. As 2007 rolled into 2008, Musk's life became more tumultuous. Tesla basically had to start over on much of the Roadster, and SpaceX still had dozens of people living in Kwajalein awaiting the next launch of the Falcon 1. Both endeavors were vacuuming up Musk's money. He started selling off prized possessions like the McLaren to generate extra cash. Musk tended to shield employees from the gravity of his fiscal situation by always encouraging them to do their best work. At the same time, he personally oversaw all significant purchases at both companies. Musk also trained employees to make the right trade-offs between spending money and productivity. This struck many of the SpaceX employees as a novel idea, since they were used to traditional aerospace companies that had huge multi-year government contracts and no day-to-day survival pressure. Elon would always be at work on Sunday, and we had some chats where he laid out his philosophy, said Kevin Brogan, the early SpaceX employee. He would say that everything we did was a function of our burn rate, and that we were burning through $100,000 per day. It was this very entrepreneurial Silicon Valley way of thinking that none of the aerospace engineers in Los Angeles were dialed into. Sometimes he wouldn't let you buy a part for $2,000 because he expected you to find it cheaper or invent something cheaper. Other times, he wouldn't flinch at renting a plane for $90,000 to get something to Quadge because it saved an entire workday, so it was worth it. He would place this urgency that he expected the revenue in 10 years to be $10 million a day, and that every day we were slower to achieve our goals was a day of missing out on that money. Musk had become all-consumed with Tesla and SpaceX out of necessity, and there can be no doubt that this exacerbated the tensions in his marriage. The Musks had a team of nannies to help with their 5 children, but Elon could not spend much time at home. He worked 7 days a week and quite often split his time between Los Angeles and San Francisco. Justine needed a change. During moments of self-reflection, she felt sickened, perceiving herself a trophy wife. Justine longed to be Elon's partner again and to feel some of that spark from their early days before life had turned so dazzling and demanding. It's not clear how much Musk let on to Justine about his dwindling bank account. She has long maintained that Musk kept her in the dark about the family's financial arrangements. But some of Musk's closest friends did get a glimpse into the worsening financial situation. In the first half of 2008, Antonio Gracias, the founder and CEO of Valor Equity, met Musk for dinner. Gracias had been an investor in Tesla and had become one of Musk's closest friends and allies, and he could see Musk agonizing over his future. Things were starting to be difficult with Justine, but they were still together, Gracias said. During that dinner, Elon said, I will spend my last dollar on these companies. If we have to move into Justine's parents' basement, we'll do it. The option of moving in with Justine's parents expired on June 16, 2008, when Musk filed for divorce. The couple did not disclose the situation right away, although Justine left hints on her blog. In late June, she posted a quotation from Moby without any additional context. There's no such thing as a well-adjusted public figure. If they were well-adjusted, they wouldn't try to be a public figure. The next entry had Justine house hunting for undisclosed reasons with Sharon Stone, and a couple of entries later she talked about a major drama that she'd been dealing with. In September, Justine wrote her first blog post explicitly about the divorce, saying, We had a good run. We married young, took it as far as we could, and now it is over. Valleywag naturally followed with a story about the divorce and noted that Musk had been seen out with a 20-something actress. The media coverage and divorce freed Justine to write about her private life in a much more liberated way. In the posts that followed, she gave her account of how the marriage ended, her views on Musk's girlfriend and future second wife, and the inner workings of the divorce proceedings. For the first time, the public had access to a deeply unpleasant portrayal of Musk and received some first-hand accounts, albeit from an ex-wife, of his hard-line behavior. The writing may have been biased, but it provided a window into how Musk operated. Here's one post about the lead-up to the divorce and its rapid execution. Divorce, for me, was like the bomb you set off when all other options have been exhausted. I had not yet given up on the diplomacy option, which was why I hadn't already filed. We were still in the early stages of marital counseling, 3 sessions total. Elon, however, took matters into his own hands. He tends to like to do that, when he gave me an ultimatum. Either we fix the marriage today, or I will divorce you tomorrow. That night, and again the next morning, he asked me what I wanted to do. I stated emphatically that I was not ready to unleash the dogs of divorce. I suggested that we hold off for at least another week. Elon nodded, touched the top of my head, and left. Later that same morning, I tried to make a purchase and discovered that he had cut off my credit card, which is when I also knew that he had gone ahead and filed. As it was, E did not tell me directly. He had another person do it. For Musk, each online missive from Justine created another public relations crisis that added to the endless stream of issues faced by his companies. The image he'd sculpted over the years appeared ready to crumble alongside his businesses. It was a disaster scenario. Soon enough, the Musks had achieved celebrity divorce status. Mainstream outlets joined ValleyWag in poring over court filings tied to the breakup, particularly as Justine fought for more money. During the PayPal days, Justine had signed a post-nuptial agreement and now argued that she didn't really have the time or inclination to dig into the ramifications of the paperwork. Justine took to her blog in an entry titled Gold Digger and said she was fighting for a divorce settlement that would include their house, alimony, and child support, $6 million in cash, 10% of Musk's Tesla stock, 5% of Musk's SpaceX stock, and a Tesla Roadster. Justine also appeared on CNBC's show Divorce Wars and wrote an article for Marie Claire titled I Was a Starter Wife, Inside America's Messiest Divorce. The public tended to side with Justine during all of this and couldn't quite figure out why a billionaire was fighting his wife's seemingly fair requests. A major problem for Musk, of course, was that his assets were anything but liquid, with most of his net worth being tied up in Tesla and SpaceX stock. The couple eventually settled with Justine getting the house, $2 million in cash, minus her legal fees, $80,000 a month in alimony and child support for 17 years, and a Tesla Roadster. Musk fought to set the record straight, as he saw it, on the Huffington Post, and wrote a 1,500-word essay. Musk maintained that 2 months of negotiations with independent parties had gone into the post-nuptial agreement, which kept the couple's assets separate so that Musk could get the spoils from his companies and Justine could get the spoils from her books. In mid-1999, Justine told me that if I proposed to her, she would say yes, Musk wrote. Since this was not long after the sale of my first company, Zip2, to Compaq, and the subsequent co-founding of PayPal, friends and family advised me to separate whether the marriage was for love or money. After the settlement, Musk asked Arianna Huffington to remove his essay about the divorce from her website. I don't want to dwell on past negativity, Musk said. You can always find things on the internet, so it's not like it's gone. It's just not easily found. Years after the settlement, Justine still struggled to speak about her relationship with Musk. During our interview, she broke down in tears several times and needed moments to compose her thoughts. Musk, she said, had hidden many things from her during their marriage and ultimately treated her much like a business adversary to be conquered during the divorce. We were at war for a while, and when you go to war with Elon, it's pretty brutal, she said. Well after their marriage ended, Justine continued to blog about Musk. She wrote about Riley and provided commentary on his parenting. One post gave Musk a hard time for banning stuffed animals from the house when their twins turned 7. Asked about this, Justine said, Elon is hardcore. He grew up in a tough culture and tough circumstances. He had to become very tough to not only thrive, but to conquer the world. He doesn't want to raise soft, overprivileged kids with no direction. Comments like these seem to indicate that Justine still admired or at least understood Musk's strong will. The pair have continued to have their difficulties. For a long time, Musk ran all of the child-sharing scheduling through his assistant, Mary Beth Brown, rather than dealing directly with Justine. I was really pissed off about that, Justine said. And the time Justine cried the most during our conversation came as she weighed the pros and cons of the children growing up on a grand stage where they're whisked away to the Super Bowl or Spain in a private jet on a moment's notice or asked to play at the Tesla factory. I know the kids really look up to him, she said. He takes them everywhere and provides a lot of experiences for them. My role as the mother is to create this reality where I provide a sense of normalcy. They are not growing up in a normal family with a normal dad. Their life with me is a lot more low-key. We value different things. I am a lot more about empathy. In the weeks after he first filed for divorce in mid-June of 2008, Musk tumbled into a deep funk. Bill Lee started to worry about his friend's mental state, and, as one of Musk's more free-spirited friends, wanted to do something to cheer him up. Now and again, Musk and Lee, an investor, would take trips overseas and mix business and pleasure. The time was right for just such a journey, and they set off for London at the start of July. The decompression program began poorly. Musk and Lee visited the headquarters of Aston Martin to see the company's CEO and get a tour of his factory. The executive treated Musk like an amateur car builder, talking down to him and suggesting that he knew more about electric vehicles than anyone else on the planet. He was a complete douche, as Lee put it, and the men did their best to make a hasty exit back to central London. Along the way, Musk had a nagging stomach pain turned severe. At the time, Lee was married to Sarah Gore, the daughter of former Vice President Al Gore, who had been a medical student, and so he called her for advice. They decided that Musk might be suffering from appendicitis, and Lee took him to a medical clinic in the middle of a shopping mall. When the tests came back negative, Lee set to work trying to goad Musk into a night on the town. "Elon didn't want to go out, and I didn't really either," Lee said. "But I was like, no, come on, we're all the way here." Lee coaxed Musk into going to a club called Whiskey Mist in Mayfair. People had packed the small, high-end dance spot, and Musk wanted to leave after 10 minutes. The well-connected Lee texted a promoter friend of his, who pulled some strings to get Musk escorted into the VIP area. The promoter then reached out to some of his prettiest friends, including a 22-year-old up-and-coming actress named Tallulah Riley, and they soon arrived at the club as well. Riley and her two gorgeous friends had come from a charity gala and were in full-length, flowing gowns. Tallulah was in this huge Cinderella thing, Lee said. Musk and Riley were introduced by people at the club, and he perked at the sight of her dazzling figure. Musk and Riley sat at a table with their friends but immediately zeroed in on each other. Riley had just hit it big with her portrayal of Mary Bennet in Pride and Prejudice, and thought of herself as quite the hotshot. The older Musk, meanwhile, took on the role of the soft-spoken, sweet engineer. He whipped out his phone and displayed photos of the Falcon 1 and Roadster, although Riley thought he had just done some work on these projects and didn't realize he ran the companies building the machines. "I remember thinking that this guy probably didn't get to talk to young actresses a lot, and that he seemed quite nervous," Riley said. "I decided to be really nice to him and give him a nice evening. Little did I know that he'd spoken to a lot of pretty girls in his life." Musk recalled their meeting as follows. "She did look great, but what was going through my mind was, oh, I guess they are a couple of models. You know, you can't actually talk to most models. You just can't have a conversation. But, you know, Tallulah was really interested in talking about rockets and electric cars. That was the interesting thing." The more Musk and Riley talked, the more Lee egged them on. It was the first time in weeks that his friend appeared happy. "His stomach didn't hurt. He's not bummed. This is great," Lee said. Despite being dressed for a fairy tale, Riley didn't fall in love with Musk at first sight. But she did become more impressed and intrigued as the night went on, particularly after the club promoter introduced Musk to a stunning model, and he politely said, "Hello," and then sat right back down with Riley. "I figured he couldn't be all bad after that," said Riley, who then allowed Musk to place his hand on her knee. Musk asked Riley out to dinner the next night, and she accepted. With her curvy figure, sultry eyes, and playful good-girl demeanor, Riley was a budding film star but didn't really act the part. She grew up in the idyllic English countryside, went to a top school, and until a week before she met Musk, had been living at home with her parents. After the night at Whiskey Mist, Riley called her family to tell them about the interesting guy she had met, who builds rockets and cars. Her father used to head up the National Crime Squad and went straight to his computer to conduct a background check that illuminated Musk's resume as a married international playboy with 5 kids. Riley's father chided his daughter for being a fool, but she held out hope that Musk had an explanation and went to dinner with him anyway. Musk brought Lee to the dinner, and Riley brought her friend Tamsin Egerton, also a beautiful actress. Things were cooler throughout the meal as the group dined in a depressingly empty restaurant. Riley wanted to see what Musk would bring up on his own. Eventually, he did announce his 5 sons and his pending divorce. The confession proved enough to keep Riley interested and curious about where things would lead. Following the meal, Musk and Riley broke off on their own. They went for a walk through Soho and then stopped at Café Bohème, where Riley, a lifelong teetotaler, sipped an apple juice. Musk kept Riley's attention, and the romance began in earnest. The couple had lunch the next day and then went to the White Cube, a modern art gallery, and then back to Musk's hotel room. Musk told Riley, a virgin, that he wanted to show her his rockets. "I was skeptical, but he did actually show me rocket videos," she said. Once Musk went back to the United States, he asked Riley to go with him, but she turned Musk down. They kept in touch via email for a couple of weeks, and then Riley booked a flight to Los Angeles. "I wasn't even thinking girlfriend or anything like that," Riley said. "I was just having fun." Musk had other ideas. Riley had been in California for just 5 days when he made his move as they lay in bed talking in a tiny room at the Peninsula Hotel in Beverly Hills. He said, "I don't want you to leave. I want you to marry me." I think I laughed. Then he said, "No, I'm serious. I'm sorry I don't have a ring." I said, "We can shake on it if you like." And we did. I don't remember what I was thinking at the time, and all I can say is that I was 22. Riley had been a model daughter up to that point, never giving her parents much of anything to worry about. She did well at school, had scored some tremendous acting gigs, and had a soft, sweet personality that her friends described as Snow White brought to life. But there she was on the hotel's balcony, informing her parents that she had agreed to marry a man 14 years her senior, who had just filed for divorce from his first wife, had 5 kids and 2 companies, and she didn't even see how she could possibly love him after knowing him for a matter of weeks. "I think my mother had a nervous breakdown," Riley said. "But I had always been highly romantic, and it actually didn't strike me as that strange." Riley flew back to England to gather her things, and her parents flew back with her to the United States to meet Musk, who belatedly asked Riley's father for his blessing. Musk did not have his own house, which left the couple moving into a home that belonged to Musk's friend, the billionaire Jeff Skoll. "I'd been living there a week when this random guy walked in," Riley said. "I said, 'Who are you?' He said, 'I am the homeowner. Who are you?' I told him, and then he just walked out." Musk later proposed to Riley again on the balcony of Skoll's house, unveiling a massive ring. He has since bought her 3 engagement rings, including the giant first one, an everyday ring, and one designed by Musk that has a diamond surrounded by 10 sapphires. "I remember him saying, 'Being with me was choosing the hard path.' I didn't quite understand at the time, but I do now. It's quite hard, quite the crazy ride." Riley experienced a baptism by fire. The whirlwind romance had given her the impression that she was engaged to a world-conquering, jet-setting billionaire. That was true in theory, but a murkier proposition in practice. As late July rolled around, Musk could see that he had just enough cash on hand to scrape through to the end of the year. Both SpaceX and Tesla would need cash infusions at some point just to pay the employees, and it was unclear where that money would come from, with the world's financial markets in disarray and investments being put on hold. If things had been going more smoothly at the companies, Musk could have felt more confident about raising money, but they were not. "He would come home every day, and there would be some calamity," Riley said. He was under immense pressure from all quarters. It was horrendous. SpaceX's third flight from Kwajalein jumped out as Musk's most pressing concern. His team of engineers had remained camped out on the island, preparing the Falcon 1 for another run. A typical company would focus